Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Trial begins in aggravated kidnapping case by Kim Smith. At first, Julian Gomez seemed like a nice guy, going so far as to fix a few things on her car, Maria Quinonez said. Then he changed. According to Quinonez, Gomez, 37, kidnapped her at gunpoint on June 3, 2020. Tuesday was the first day of Gomez's trial on an aggravated kidnapping charge in the 70th Ector County District Court. Quinonez, a single mother of three girls, told jurors Gomez sent her a friend request on Facebook in the latter part of 2019, and they quickly began exchanging instant messages and texts. They met in person in February 2020 and became intimate toward the end of March, although they weren't seeing each other exclusively, she said. Because she had been the victim of domestic violence in the past, Quinonez, 39, said she was wary about bringing new men around her children until she felt she knew them. During the beginning of her relationship with Gomez, Quinonez said she mostly went with him to his RV in Midland. As time went on, Quinonez changed from being a nice person to being short-tempered. She told jurors he began cursing her out a lot and showing up unannounced at her house and at her friends' homes. He would also text her things like, "I can see your car," and instruct her to go home. When he showed up unannounced, he'd demand she come out to his car to talk. He used my past against me. He knew I didn't like confrontations in front of my kids, and he'd say if I didn't want my kids to see that, I needed to get into his car to talk, Quinonez said. In May, Quinonez said she decided to end the relationship after discovering him smoking methamphetamine with the girlfriend of one of his friends. She told his friend about the incident, and that set Gomez off, Quinonez said. He began sending her dozens and dozens of expletive-laced texts and voice messages telling her he was going to kill her for ruining his life. Every time she blocked the call, Gomez would just call and text from a new number, she told Assistant Ector County Attorney Courtney Williams. One day, Gomez showed up at her home, and fearing for her safety and that of her kids, Quinonez said she got into his car. He took her to his home, and over the next several hours, Gomez would go back and forth from telling her he loved her to threatening her life, all while working on two guns, Quinonez said. He tried to rip off her clothes at one point, but then changed his mind, she said. I guess he felt bad, but then would say, "Look what you made me do," she said. In order to calm him down and convince him to take her home, Quinonez testified she apologized for actions, said she loved him, and assured them they could fix their relationship. I didn't think I was going to get out of there. She told jurors Gomez made her smoke methamphetamine with him so she could no longer paint him as a bad guy. When Gomez went to the restroom, she ran outside and hid in the bushes, but gave herself up because he had gotten in his car to look for her, and it became clear to her he wasn't going to give up searching for her, Quinonez said. He eventually took her home, but over the following weeks he continued to cyberstalk her relentlessly. He repeatedly threatened to burn down her house with her kids inside, she said. On June 3, 2020, Quinonez said she was driving to her Southside home from a friend's house on East 35th Street when Gomez suddenly appeared next to her car in his car, cut her off, pointed a gun at her, and told her to pull over. She obliged because I was afraid he was going to shoot, she testified. During the drive to his home in Midland, he held a gun to her head and fired it out the passenger side window in front of her face, later telling her he was using blanks. He demanded to see her phone and she threw it away, she said. She managed to convince him that she loved him and she would meet him later that day. Convinced, he dropped her off at her car shortly after 5 a.m., Quiñones said. She found her phone, called her daughters, and told them to get out of the house. Her son was at his father's. She later drove to the Odessa Police Department to make a report. That day, Quiñones said she again began receiving dozens and dozens of texts from various phones threatening her life, her children's lives, and the lives of friends she was staying with. She made screenshots of many of the messages, and she read them for jurors. "I'm not going to stop being crazy or nothing until you put my heart to rest," read one text. Many of the texts blasted Quiñones for lying to him about her love for him. "If you're scared, you're going to be more scared if you don't show up at 4 p.m., read one. "If you keep messing with Azul, I'll make sure he doesn't see you again," read another. "By tomorrow, your life better change up," said one text. "If you press charges, your life is only going to get worse," said another. During cross-examination from defense attorney Luis Chavez, Quiñones denied being a drinker or being drunk the night of the alleged kidnapping. She acknowledged she did not call 911 at several points during the night, despite Chavez's suggestion that she could have. She also acknowledged that she didn't go to OPD until 2 p.m. that day, despite the fact she says Gomez forced her to park her car just 7 blocks from the station, and he dropped her off at the same location. During opening statements, law school student Antonio Chavez, who also represents Gomez, told jurors prosecutors will not be able to prove Gomez had a gun that night or that he forced Quiñones to go with him. He said Quiñones went willingly with Gomez because she didn't want to return home to her children. Aggravated assault trial underway by Kim Smith. When one half of a neighborhood dispute failed to answer their knock on the door that day in September, Odessa Police Corporal Gary Potter said he and a fellow officer decided to stick around in case the dispute erupted again. It did. Potter was the first witness on the stand Tuesday in the trial of Nathan Peter Gordon, 31. Gordon is facing 5 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon in the 358th Ector County District Court. Potter told jurors he was working patrol last September when he received a call about 11 p.m. about a dispute in an apartment complex in the 4600 block of Oakwood Drive. When he and another officer arrived, they were told Gordon was creating problems with neighbors who lived below his second-story apartment. After speaking with the neighbors, they went upstairs, knocked on Gordon's door twice, and announced they were with the police department. He didn't come to the door. About 45 minutes later, Potter said he and Officer Bandy Blackman were still in the parking lot when a second 911 call came in from the same neighbors. As they ran toward the apartment, Potter said he heard very, very loud screaming and a man yelling, "Ready," in Spanish. He also heard a man using expletives, yelling for someone to go ahead and call the police. As he looked upstairs, Potter said he saw a man waving around a machete, and he heard Blackman yelling, "Show me your hands, show me your hands." The man later identified as Gordon yelled back, "I ain't got no hands," and then turned and went back to his apartment. Ector County District Attorney William Prasher, who is trying the case with colleague Carmen Villabos, told jurors during opening statements Gordon was arrested 4 hours later after police used tear gas to gain entry into his apartment. Prasher said the whole event started when Gordon became upset that 2 women were chatting outside their first-floor apartment and may have gotten a little loud. The women were so frightened by Gordon confronting them, they called police and then a few family members. In all, 5 people were there when Gordon began harassing them again, this time with a machete, Prasher said. Defense attorney Kevin Acker waived his opening statement. Obituaries and death notices from the Odessa American for Wednesday. Robert Eugene Norwood, 82, of Powderly, Texas, passed away on Friday, June 24th at his home. Services are scheduled for 3 p.m. Wednesday, June 29th, at Bright Holland Funeral Home, with Reverend Fred Fangio and Reverend Barry Loving officiating. The family will receive friends at the funeral home 1 hour prior to the service. Robert, the son of Roy W. Norwood and Ruby D. Williams Norwood, was born February 1, 1940, in Glendale, Arizona. His parents and a sister, Juanita Perrigan, preceded him in death. Survivors include his wife, Shirley Patton Norwood, two daughters, Kathy Setzler and husband Rick, and Diana Crutchfield and husband Jerry, a sister, Beulah Chisholm, stepdaughters Cindy Smith and husband Donnie, Diane Fauscher and husband Ken, Trina Clevenger and husband Mark, and Carrie Albrighton and husband Gary, four grandchildren, four great-grandchildren, a great-great-grandchild, along with numerous step-grandchildren and step-great-grandchildren, and a host of friends. To leave a message or tribute for the family, please visit www.bright-hollandfuneralhome.com. Mary Helen Munoz, wife to Alfonso Munoz, mother to Brenna Hill and Chris Hill, and Bianca Palan, and stepdaughter Lily Munoz, sister to Ricky and Rosie Estella, Sammy Rangel, Nat Jr. and Florinda, Raul and Diane and Carlos Huerta, many brother and sisters-in-law, grandmother to eight. We want to invite you all to join us in the celebration of her life Thursday, June 30th. We will hold a viewing from 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. at Acres West Funeral Home in Odessa. On Friday, July 1st, viewing will be open from 2 p.m., memorial service at 6 p.m. We welcome all stories, blessings she brought to your life, pictures to view on those days. Any contributions can be made directly to Acres West in her name. Jackie Yvonne Keene, 70, passed from this life on Wednesday, June 22nd, at her home in Odessa. She was born on Sunday, February 2, 1952, to Juanita and Johnny Kite in La Mesa, Texas. Those left to cherish her memory are her husband, Greg Keene, sons Bill Shane Alexander of Noble, Oklahoma, Johnny Alexander and wife Laura of Bryan, Texas, and Scott Keene of San Angelo, daughter Juanita and Pi Alexander of Canyon Lake, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Visitation will start on Tuesday, June 28th, from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m., and funeral services are scheduled for Wednesday, June 29th, at 10 a.m. at Acres West Funeral Chapel, with burial to follow at Sunset Memorial Gardens. Condolences to the family may be made online at acreswestfuneral.com. Jaime Jimmy Aranaga, 76, of Odessa, died Saturday, June 25th in San Angelo. Mass will be celebrated at 2 p.m. Thursday, June 30th, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Burial to follow at Ector County Cemetery, Rose Hill Section. Father Frank Chavez is officiating. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. K. Rita Gerald, 63, of Odessa, died Friday, June 24th, in Odessa. Funeral service is scheduled for 1 p.m. June 30th at Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. Reverend David Newton is officiating. Arrangements are by Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home of Odessa. Victor P. Kipkin III, 71, of Fort Stockton, died Saturday, June 11th in Odessa. Graveside service is scheduled for 9 a.m. Saturday, July 2nd, at East Hill Cemetery in Fort Stockton. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Mike Oden, 70, of Odessa, died Sunday, June 21st in Odessa. Memorial service is scheduled for 10 a.m. Friday, July 1st, at Faith Community Baptist Church. Brother Wayne Shelton is officiating. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Amelia Rios Sanchez, 86, of Odessa, died Saturday, June 25th in Odessa. Mass will be celebrated at 11 a.m. June 29th at St. Elizabeth Ann Seton Catholic Church. At the family's request, burial will be held privately at a later date and time. Father Joe Barberi is officiating. Arrangements are by Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, June 25, 2022. Viewpoints. America needs plan to ease economic woes. Biden administration continues to worsen scarcity, inflation with every agency action. All across the United States, Americans are suffering from a missing energy and economic policy that has wrought havoc for families and their budgets over the last 6 months. In May, those costs included a 5.5% increase in housing, an 11.9% increase for groceries, and a whopping 48.7% increase in gasoline. The impact of these costs and a general inflation rate nearing 9% means Americans will continue to pay more to get the same. Consumers have long known that these economic woes are not transitory or simply a result from geopolitical unrest. Based on their actions and rhetoric, however, we are left to ask, does the Biden administration know the same thing? The answer is very clearly, no. These economic woes are, at best, the product of a misguided and incoherent economic and energy plan from the administration and, at worst, the intentional efforts of creating unsustainable and unaffordable access to energy for millions of Americans. 7 months ago, we wrote, the president has at his disposal more than 10 million energy workers looking to rechart America's path back to energy independence and energy security, all the while protecting our nation's natural resources and the environment better than any foreign producers would even consider. With pro-energy policies, American oil and gas workers would have no trouble producing energy for Americans and exporting it to our allies abroad. Yet, despite rather uneasy foretelling, the Biden administration continues to plot a course towards energy scarcity and higher inflation with every agency action. Publicly, the administration continues to propose short-sighted policies that can only act like baling wire and duct tape to a disjointed and failing economic and energy policy that is costing Americans more each day and driving our nation into recession. The administration this year has begun releasing oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, with that action having little to no effect on inflation and prices at the pump. The administration also asked Russia and Middle Eastern nations as part of OPEC Plus to increase production to drive down prices. Yet, consumers are still experiencing higher and higher costs. Further, the administration has even reached out to China and sought to visit with Latin American leaders to request they be the solution to our energy crunch. The oil and natural gas producers of America, however, still have received no genuine outreach from the administration. Despite this reality, the Permian Basin, which has been producing oil and natural gas for more than 100 years, is producing those fuel sources at record amounts. Yet, this year, the Biden administration has also limited oil and gas opportunities on state and federal lands, and in the first 9 days in office, the administration unveiled three orders alone, which further restricted oil and gas development throughout the United States. No action has been taken by the administration since those early days to actually encourage or increase oil and natural gas development in the United States. And recently, only after losing a lawsuit, has the administration begun working to lease more oil and gas properties, something they were required to do by statute anyway. However, the lead time for those leases to become developed are also hindered by long delays in permitting that the federal government manages. Even though the administration knows American consumers need relief from increasing energy costs and inflation, they continue to take aim at oil and gas development. Based on its implementation by the Carter administration back in the 1970s, the administration's new proposal of a windfall profits tax on the oil and natural gas industry will only work to decrease domestic production and drive costs for consumers even higher. The administration's recently articulated new proposals that would continue to utilize the Endangered Species Act to limit areas of production in the Permian Basin, a region that has grown from producing less than 17% of total U.S. oil production to more than 40% in the last 15 years, would further limit domestic production and drive consumer costs higher. And a new and wholly unwarranted effort to move the Permian Basin into ozone non-attainment would have devastating impacts on the region that continues to lead the nation in oil and gas production, once again causing the consumer to suffer the most. The administration isn't stopping there. They have begun targeting capital investment in the oil and gas development sector with new rules from the Securities and Exchange Commission, which would further hamper the sector from providing relief to Americans, a proposal to which 24 state attorneys general have expressed opposition. At a time when our country needs more energy production to reduce costs on consumers, limit inflation, and keep our nation from going into recession, this administration's response has been to offer policy after policy that instead will limit domestic production and make our nation more and more reliant on foreign powers. Under these policies, American consumers will find themselves cutting back on essentials to fuel and feed their families. The administration's response to those folks seems to be, if they can't afford bread anymore, let them eat cake. The examples offered above are only a few that fully illustrate the absolute lack of regulatory certainty or a coherent policy focused on energy and economic development in the United States, which has continued to produce more oil and gas with a better environmental record than anywhere in the world. PBPA continues to ask the Biden administration to view our members and their efforts as partners in solving his energy and economic crisis. In the meantime, we are not waiting to offer help. We will continue to safely and responsibly produce our region's natural resources for the benefit of Americans and our allies abroad. Ben Shepherd, President, Permian Basin Petroleum Association.
Visual Snow Syndrome. To your good health for Wednesday. Dear Dr. Roach, a friend of my 31-year-old daughter has just been diagnosed with visual snow syndrome. He is devastated, since his profession depends heavily on being able to see clearly. I understand that the disease is not physiological, but rather neurological. Is this disease incurable? Is there a genetic link? Do you know of any studies underway? Dr. Roach writes, visual snow syndrome is new to me. It is a rare disorder where people notice snow-like dots throughout the visual field. It can sometimes begin in childhood, and apparently there are adults who can never recall having vision without those kinds of dots, which can cause significant loss of visual acuity and psychological consequences, as you might well imagine. A 2017 review of the condition identified this as related to, but distinct from, migraine with aura. They proposed two treatments. One medicine normally used for seizures, amotrigine, and another used for migraine, among other conditions, verapamil. The authors noted that this does not cure the disease, but can improve vision significantly enough to make a real impact on people's lives. A second review from 2020 suggested medication therapy as unfortunately not effective much of the time, and suggested the wearing of colored glasses, blue, yellow, as being helpful in some people with this condition. I did find a trial in Colorado recruiting patients for transcranial magnetic stimulation for this condition. You can find it at clinicaltrials.gov.
Hi, this is Denisa, reading the Midland Reporter Telegram, Dear Abby column, for Wednesday, June 29th, 2022. Victim of physical violence still wrestles with impact. Dear Abby, many years ago, I was the victim of a violent assault that my then 11-year-old daughter witnessed. It traumatized both of us, but me the worst. I completely dove off the deep end. I started drinking and smoking pot and quit going to church. My whole personality changed. I dumped every moment with my children I could onto my husband so I could go out with my friends to clubs, bars, concerts, or parties. I then started having affairs with many different people, including women. My husband knew about all of it, and despite the torture and pain I put him through, he stayed with me. Years later, I have managed to slowly heal from that devastating assault. I have found true joy in my children and being a mom again. I don't party, drink, or smoke anymore. But one thing has become clear. I'm no longer sexually attracted to my husband. I love him very much, but the thought of being intimate with him grosses me out. It makes me so uncomfortable. I don't even like it when he tries to caress me. It has been like this for a year, but I do love holding hands with him and cuddling with him. I feel bad because I know he has needs, but I just can't bring myself to get physical with him. I've actually thought that leaving him might be necessary because he has never fully healed from what I've done, and I'm struggling with finding other men attractive. Abby, what do I do? Putting the pieces back together. Dear Pudding, please accept my sympathy for what happened to you. I am struck by the fact that nowhere in your letter did you mention receiving counseling after the assault. If you didn't, please seek a referral to a licensed mental health professional now so you can understand the connection between what you experienced in your assault and your lack of feelings for your husband. You owe it to both of you. Go online and search on services for victims of crime in your state. Help is available through these resources. Alternatively, your physician or health insurance provider can give you a referral. Explain to your husband that the problem isn't him, it's you, and you will be getting help for it. Please don't wait to reach out because help is available. Dear Abby, my 45-year-old son is getting married to a lovely girl. More good news. She is an heiress and in a financial bracket that I can never compete with. They are having a big wedding. I need help finding a gift that will have meaning to them. They already have a house, fancy trips, and everything they need. Baffled in Ohio. Dear Baffled, because you're not an heiress, consider giving them something money can't buy. Something personal. If she cooks when they're not traveling or has someone do it for them, a collection of your family's recipes, especially your son's favorites, might be appreciated. And if they plan on to start a family later on, consider giving his wife his baby book if you made one for him.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.